For that bill that I just gave, someone that he signed.
Okay. Yeah, he needs that back.
Oh, I guess so. Okay.
Ready?
The Senate Judiciary and Public Safety Committee will come to order. For the record, this is Thursday, April 28th, 2011. We have five bills today, and they're going to be rather involved discussions. And we'll want to keep our commentary brief and to the point. Senator Ortman, which one would you want to start with first? Is it Senate File 149?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. I'm happy to begin with Senate File 149, which is first on the agenda, if you would like.
It's your choice, but why don't we start with Senate File 149?
All right. Well, maybe what I'll do, if it's all right with you, Senator and Mr. Chair, would be to just briefly introduce the three bills that relate to lawsuit reform that I'm carrying. And I know that there are folks that would like to speak to them generally and maybe make some comments to them as a group, if that would be acceptable to the chair and the members.
That would be acceptable. However, we'll be voting on them individually.
Of course, Senator, and I appreciate that.
Please proceed.
Member, Senate File 149 relates to class action lawsuits. And for those unfamiliar with a class action lawsuit, that's where one plaintiff files a lawsuit, but there are so many similarly situated plaintiffs that they're all allowed to act together as one plaintiff or separately if they would like. And when they do that, it tends to, once a class is certified, it tends to basically blow up the lawsuit, if you will, because on the defense side, imagine having one plaintiff, but hundreds of plaintiffs. And so each individual plaintiff can file a request for a deposition, can file interrogatories, requests for documents, subpoenas, can really tie up a defendant's litigation department or really require them to hire many lawyers to just manage the caseload. And so when they do that, there's often a huge incentive to settle those class action lawsuits and not necessarily press for justice because it's so cost-intensive to manage all those plaintiffs that folks find it to be necessary to settle. And we really don't want that. We don't want to encourage folks to settle if they think that there's a legitimate defense. And so there's a pretty straightforward way to deal with that, and that would be to authorize an appeal to the Court of Appeals once the certification decision is made by the district court. One of the other pieces of that bill is to ensure that folks who are filing lawsuits actually have damages, that they've actually been injured and have articulable damages. So that's Senate File 149. Senate File 373 would change our default statute of limitations for most of our lawsuits and claims under Minnesota law. We have a specific statute of limitations. It could be 2 years, it could be four, it could be six, it could be actually longer than that. In certain cases, it actually goes all the way out to 15 years. But we also have a default. So if we haven't specified what it is, it automatically ends up being 6 years. And we want to change that six-year default statute of limitations to 4 years. It makes sense to change it to 4 years for a couple of reasons. It's a big unknown for the defendants. For 6 years to carry the potential liability known or unknown is a very big burden for defendants. It also allows cases to languish. The witnesses, the evidence sometimes end up being diminished or not available by the time that the lawsuits get filed. And so that's another disincentive. There are 39 states that have a much shorter default period. It's 3 years, 2 years. In some states, it's even 1 year. It makes sense for us to shorten this so we have more predictability and certainty in our courts. It also saves in costs. Imagine having to maintain a lawsuit, not only all the period of the statute of limitations, but then beyond. That means lawsuits then and claims take 7, 8, or even more years before we reach final resolution for potential claims. Most of the claims that are affected by this change in the statute of limitations would include contracts, indebtedness, products liability, personal injury. The ones that it makes sense to say 4 years should be enough. That is Senate File 373. And if I could skip to Senate File 530, Senate File 530 addresses prejudgment interest amounts. We currently, under current Minnesota law, have two standards for prejudgment interest. For private litigants, it's 10%, meaning from the date that the injury occurs all the way through the end of the lawsuit and the payment of any kind of award or liability, that claim earns 10% over the course of the trial. If it's 10%, which is way higher than the free market, there's actually an incentive to park your claim in a court and earn 10%, where the market would never pay you 10% for an investment. We changed that law in 2009. Some of us were very much against that increase in prejudgment interest because it, again, incentivizes folks to maintain lawsuits and not resolve them earlier if they can. It was changed to 10% in 2009. We said in opposition, many of us, that it would raise the costs of litigation. The next year, what happened? Folks came back with an amendment and changed it so that governmental units only have to have a 4% prejudgment interest rate, but the private sector must pay 10%. And so you can see we couldn't live by our own standards once we passed it in 2009. So I would ask you to look at Senate File 530 and support it. There is one other bill on the agenda that I'll present. It's not part of this package. It is also a tort reform. We'll talk about that one separately. But there are folks that would like to testify about Senate File 149, Senate File 373, Senate File 530, and also Senate File 429, which I believe Senator Newman is going to present today. Some very esteemed members of our business community and residents of the state of Minnesota have joined a group called Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform. It's not just a business organization. It also represents many individuals who are asking for these reforms. And I would just say that some of these reforms were not brought here at the request of businesses, although businesses are very much supportive of these changes. But I'll tell you that I personally brought the interlocutory appeal legislation many years ago without any prompting, just because I saw that there was a need in the system for that, the statute of limitations as well, and you also know about the conciliation court limits that we all passed just a couple of weeks ago onto the Finance Committee. This is not driven by business, but it is absolutely supported by business. 58,000 members of the group called Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform are asking us to look at this because it's in the interest of justice to make these changes. It makes sense for us to do what we can to improve the resolution time in our courts of law. It makes sense for us to try and help Minnesotans get swift resolution of their claims in our courts. It also helps us with efficiency. It helps the courts. It actually saves costs to our court system. And then, just as importantly, members, our defendants and litigants, whether they are plaintiffs or defendants, spend an awful lot of opportunity cost in our courts managing litigation when they could be spending those same resources, their energy, their time, their talents, their folks in their businesses, and focus more on business growth, developing a new product, hiring new employees, making another sale. That's where we want them to focus. We don't want them to lose time and opportunity and costs stuck in our courtrooms and litigation. Let's move these cases along as swiftly as possible. Let's eliminate any incentives to stall or delay, and let's eliminate them all if we can. These are three or four very good common sense ways that we can do that. With that, members and Mr. Chair, Mr. Bob Johnson from the Minnesota Insurance Federation is here, and he'll help me to introduce the other testifiers.
Mr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed.
I will. Mr. Chairman, thank you. And committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. But I'm really here today as a board member of the Minnesotans for Lawsuit Reform, as Senator Ortman had indicated. I know you have in your packet a sheet of paper so you can see a listing of the Minnesota trade associations and chambers of commerce and individual businesses that has grown dramatically in the last 12 months in membership. to today, as Senator Ortman said, over 58,000 employers and job producers in the state. And so we come here today in strong support of these agenda reforms, and I really wanted to make just a couple of comments, and then I don't need to repeat these, obviously, on each bill because it's the overview. But I think this group, as we have met and looked at the Minnesota laws and the system, firmly believe that an efficient tort liability system, it is an important ingredient for a healthy and thriving and growing free enterprise private market, that a civil justice system that's balanced and predictable and affordable is important, and it's directly relevant to the jobs and economic development and climate in the state of Minnesota. That's why we're here today. That's why we're supporting these bills. From our perspective, there's direct evidence available. We don't have it here today to spend the time on, but I'll just give the reference, and we've talked with some of you about this. Just a two-year-old study out of the state of Texas done by a group called the Perryman Group, that's an economic research consulting business in that state, that specifically looked at a 10-year period of time in the Texas economy and the legislature at four tort reform bills that were passed from 1995 to 2008, and to measure, did those tort reform bills have any quantifiable impact on the Texas economy? And their conclusion was the net effect of that was a gain of 500,000 jobs in the Texas economy and an increase of revenue dollars in that state specifically attributable to those changes of $112 billion. And so that's a document that's a detailed document that goes through the economic analysis and the statewide analysis. And the second document, it's the Pacific Research Institute. There's a United States Tort Liability Index. It's a 2010 report that a very comprehensive study and analysis of all 50 states looking at the state of their state laws. In terms of, it's about 30 specific areas, what's the condition or what laws do each of the states have, and then looking at the tort outputs, what are the costs, if you will, what are the courts awarding, and then just ranking all the states. And I mention that because this Pacific Research Institute study then ranks the states. Number one is the best package of state laws in a multitude of areas. Minnesota ranks 47th in that study. So in other words, we're third from the bottom in the state, the quality of the state laws. And then they look at the tort outputs, what's actually coming out of the system. And actually, their ranking on that is in the middle. It's a 26th ranking. So we're right in the middle of the pack on that. And I just reference that because that study then also specifically looks at the quantification of how tort reform is relevant to jobs in states' economies. So I guess for this broad group, we believe that, we're committed to that. We believe that these bills and the package, the bills that Senator Ortman has referenced here, deal with specific areas in the Minnesota law that we believe there's some unfairness, there's some inequities, and there's room for improvement to help these goals of the efficiency, the balance, the predictable, and affordability to individuals in the state impacted by the system. So. That, Mr. Chairman, is my kind of brief overview comments of the reason why we're here, why we're supporting the bills, the reason for that support, and what we think is going to come out of if Minnesota moves ahead in each of these areas of the law changes.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank
Senator
you.
Ortman.
Mr. Chair, we have a guest today, Mr. Court Sylvester, who is an attorney with the Neelan Johnson Lewis and Jewett Lewis Law Firm. And he has experience in class actions and will also testify about the prejudgment interest bill.
Mr. Johnson, if you could remain seated, please. Senator Latz has a question for you. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, could you provide me with a copy of those reports or at least a citation so I can look them up?
Yes,
Mr. Johnson.
If you have one today, that'd be great.
We have the electronic reference. We'll send you an email and you can... links.
While we're in hearing right now, if you could give it to me now, I'll have staff pull it up at least so I can take a
okay.
look at it.
Mr. Johnson. We have it in the files back here. We'll dig it
Thank
up.
Thank
you. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Sylvester is here to testify, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Sylvester, welcome to the committee, if you would state your name and then please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Court Sylvester. I am a shareholder with the Nyland Johnson Lewis Law Firm in Minneapolis. I have a practice in civil litigation. I've represented employers in manufacturing and other industries in Minnesota and throughout the country, and I've actually represented parties on both sides of the V, both plaintiffs and defendants in civil litigation for a number of years, although my primary practice at the moment is in the areas of product liability and commercial litigation and some appellate work as well. If the chair will permit, I'm actually here to speak on two of the bills, both Senate File 530, the prejudgment interest bill, and Senate File 149, the class action bill.
Mr. Sylvester, and what I would request is if you would confine your remarks to the bill before us at this point, that way we can stay organized and on track.
Certainly, I will do so. So speaking to, as my understanding that the bill currently before the committee is Senate File 149,
that's
the class
correct.
Action interlocutory appeal and proof of actual damage and reliance bill. And the core of that bill is the realization that class actions are special. Class actions are a different kind of lawsuit from the standard lawsuit that our courts handle on a day-to-day basis. And Senate File 149 helps to ensure that that which distinguishes class actions from other individualized lawsuits is true, accurate, and valid before the courts and the parties must invest the vast resources that are necessary to handle a class action. The bill does two things, in essence. It first requires proof of actual reliance and damage by those who wish to claim damages pursuant to a class action. And it second allows for an interlocutory appeal, an appeal during the course of the litigation of the decision to certify a lawsuit as a class action. That is, the appeal would be taken before the rest of the lawsuit proceeds, as opposed to waiting until a final decision has been rendered in the trial and then appealing after all that has been done. The first of those requirements is a way to give meaning to rules that are actually already imposed on class actions. Anyone wishing to claim damages pursuant to a class action must file a proof of claim with the court if they wish to participate as a member of the plaintiff class. And all that this bill does is it requires that each of those individuals who believe that they have a valid claim present that proof on an individualized basis. That is, they must say, I myself actually suffered damages. Here's the proof that I lost some money, I incurred some injury on an individualized basis. And then second, if it is particularly a consumer fraud, consumer protection statute class action, proof that whatever business transaction, purchase or whatever, that person engaged in that they allege gave rise to their injury, that they actually entered that transaction because of the allegedly fraudulent or improper conduct that they are alleging the defendant committed. And that's something that they should have to be able to prove to participate in the class action in the first place. And this statute gives teeth to those requirements, which are already in place under certain rules, but which are not clear under Minnesota statutes at the current time. The second thing that the bill does is it allows for an immediate appeal of the decision to call a lawsuit a class action. What currently happens is the judge renders a decision on the motion to declare that it is a valid class action. And if the judge says yes, then the case must proceed all the way through the final judgment. And at that point, the defendant may challenge the decision to certify the class. And if the Court of Appeals then decides this was not a proper class, the courts and the parties have wasted all of that time, effort, and resources litigating the class action. What this bill does is it allows the Court of Appeals to immediately render judgment without having to go through that whole process on whether or not the decision to call it a class action was correct. And that's a decision which ought to be made before the class proceeds because, after all, class actions are different. They are not the same as a normal case, And the Court of Appeals should have the opportunity to decide whether the judge got that right in saying this truly is a different kind of action. So that's why it makes sense in a practical and legal context to adopt Senate File 149 and improve the procedures that we currently use for class actions in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvester. Any questions from any committee members? Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Sylvester, how do you envision the proof occurring that an individual was somehow harmed by the deceptive trade practice?
Mr. Sylvester.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Currently, when class actions are proceeding and individuals wish to participate in the class, they are required to file with the court a proof of claim indicating that they incurred some damage or that they meet the requirements for participating in the class. And the same kind of filing could be used to comply with Senate File 149. It's hard to say precisely what the requirement, the content requirements of that proof would be in every case, because every class action has different issues. But there should be, and the bill requires, proof that they actually relied upon the allegedly improper conduct. So there would have to be some indication that, yes, I bought this product or entered into this contract because of what we claim the defendant did wrong. And then second, they would include a statement that, you know, I paid this much or I lost this much money out of pocket. It wouldn't have to involve all of the evidence supporting the amount of damages, but it would ideally include a statement of the some approximation of the amount of actual loss to show that they in fact lost something out of pocket.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Lance.
Mr. Sylvester, so an affidavit that they believe the ad that was allegedly deceptive and that they lost 25 cents on the purchase, that would be sufficient in your mind?
Mr. Sylvester.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It possibly could, depending upon the particular parameters of the class action. An affidavit often suffices to meet similar types of requirements in different contexts, so that would be an option.
Senator Latz.
And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sylvester, would you, does the bill require each person covered by the class to provide that proof, or would it apply only to the lead plaintiffs, the named plaintiffs in the case?
Mr. Sylvester.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My understanding of the bill is that it would would apply to anyone who seeks to participate in a manner in which they would claim damages. It would certainly apply to the lead named plaintiffs as well, as it should, because those plaintiffs must be representative of the alleged class, and they would have to prove that they suffered not only damages, but the kind of damages that the class as a whole is alleged to have suffered. But the individual claimants seeking recovery would have to present some proof that they, in fact, meet the requirements of the class.
Senator Lyle.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sylvester, so if a class is certified that 100,000 Minnesotans who purchased Cheerios between March 1st and March 31st of 2011 ended up overpaying 10 cents because of a deceptive advertisement or something, are you saying each of those 100,000 people, if they were going to be covered in a class action, let's say there were a way to identify those individuals somehow and to notify them, typically, as I understand, it's an opt-out, not an opt-in for classes. Yeah. Opt out if you want to pursue a lawsuit separately. Would each of those 100,000 people have to submit an affidavit to be able to recover something in this kind of a case then?
Mr. Sylvester.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, your description of opt out versus opt in, for instance, depends upon how the court characterizes the class. There are some opt in classes. There are also some opt out classes. In the scenario that you describe, however, depending again upon the particular issues and particular parameters of the definition of the class, what those individuals might have to prove is that, in fact, they spent money on the product, and if it's an issue of overpayment, they would have to establish that their out-of-pocket loss truly exists for them to participate in a valid fashion as a member of the class. So it's hard to speak to specifics because the specific nature of the lawsuit is important in determining the nature of proof. But there would have to be some kind of demonstration. And if the court decides an affidavit is proper, if there, on the other hand, is a particular form that the court could approve, that form could be submitted. Those matters of procedure aren't necessarily spelled out in the bill as I understand it.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Latz, to your question, a pretty good hypothetical would be a television ad in the market in Minnesota. It would be $250 airline tickets to round trip to, you know, Miami. And unfortunately, when folks buy the airline ticket, they end up paying $300. There was something deceptive about the ad. It's just a hypothetical. What this bill would do is require that if you're going to be a member of the class, that you actually have bought a ticket and you actually paid some of that money over the $250, that you were actually defrauded. This would not apply to the potential plaintiff who would say, I saw the ad, I didn't buy a ticket, but I wish I would have because I would have liked to go to Florida. This just says you actually have to have been seen the ad, relied on the ad, and taken some step and incurred some damage as a result of the deception. And that's all this bill does. And then it says we're not going to have members of the class. We're not going to, once we certify that class, the judge, we're going to allow the defendants to go immediately to the Court of Appeals before they have to defend against a lawsuit that has hundreds or thousands of potential plaintiffs.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Letts.
Senator Ortman, are you saying that the judge couldn't even certify a class until after this level of proof was presented that there were more than just a couple of named plaintiffs affected?
Senator Ortman.
Senator Letts, no.
Mr. Sylvester, the way I'm looking at this bill, where we're talking about actual out-of-pocket loss, in class action suits, that's often a very, very, or can be, I should say, a very small amount. And am I correct in assuming that there is no limit in that respect, that the you're not setting any kind of a limit? It could be, as Senator Latz alluded, say 25 cents, or it could be a significant sum. Am I correct on that?
Mr. Chair, I believe that is correct. My reading of the bill does not include a minimum amount of requirement. What amount of damages they would or out-of-pocket loss the individual claims would have to prove would depend upon the nature of the alleged injury that the class deals with. So there may be some cases where it is very small. There may be some cases where it is more substantial.
And the reason I ask the question, Mr. Sylvester, is that, you know, oftentimes you will hear the public be very critical of class action suits. And I have always thought that there is a certain amount of or a certain element within a class action suit that provides some degree of protection for the public because of wrongdoing. And I'm wondering if you would comment on that part or that element of class action suits in terms of whether or not you believe they do serve a purpose, even though the individual members of the class may have suffered a very small amount of damage. The defendant or defendants involved often have reaped very large sums of money for their benefits. I just wonder if you could comment on that.
Senator, that goes somewhat beyond, as I understand it, the nature of what this bill would do to class action procedure in Minnesota, in the sense that whatever the public policy reasons there are for having class actions, and some of them that you described are, in fact, the policy justifications for class action lawsuits, this bill would not take away class actions. It would not eliminate the ability of claimants to make class action litigation have a public benefit like that, even though each individual claimant gets very, very little money. My understanding of the bill is that it, in fact, preserves those fundamental purposes of class action litigation. What it tries to do is tries to balance those public policy interests with the countervailing public policy interests and the economic interests of the courts and the defendants in these cases, to have some protection against those types of lawsuits imposing adverse economic consequences on the courts and the defendants, purely to seek some benefit which is intangible, which can't be quantified, or which may stray from the purposes of class actions. And my understanding is that SF 149 tries to right that balance to a certain extent without eliminating the benefits of class actions.
Thank you, Mr. Sylvester. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a question. Now, I'm not an attorney, so I am not familiar with all the legal language. But what I'd like to know is, take for example, I'd like to just throw out another example and see how you respond to this, that somebody's taking an, or a group of people have taken an anti-inflammatory, maybe ibuprofen or something that they then find out has caused some problems with their liver or something. And this takes time for it to show up, but few months or whatever. So would they have to have the receipt for the bottle of ibuprofen in order to be part of this class action suit? Or would they just have to, would they have to prove actual liver damage in order to be part of this class action suit?
Mr. Sylvester.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, I don't believe the bill imposes any of those kinds of requirements in the sense that in order to participate in such a class now, a person who believed that they had been injured in that fashion would already have to establish that they took that drug and that they actually suffered the kind of injury that the class focuses upon. And those requirements of proof are already in place. This bill doesn't change those requirements. It merely shifts, to a certain extent, it shifts the timing and says that in order to participate in certain types of class actions where you are alleging that money has been lost and we're seeking to recover the money that was lost in those consumer transactions, the proof that they actually lost that money, some form of that proof or some amount of that proof, has to come up front before they become part of that class. So my understanding is that your scenario would not be one in which this bill creates additional barriers.
Senator, okay. Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have another question. Does this have any impact on home warranties and somebody losing, having property losses because of shoddy construction or something like that? Does this have, or a group of people under the same builder, does this affect statutory home warranties at all, or builders or roofers or insurance companies that cover them? Does this have any impact on that?
Mr. Sylvester.
Mr. Chair, it doesn't affect the content of the law that governs those kinds of transactions, so it wouldn't change the warranty requirements on such builders or other parties. It doesn't change the law that determines whether they have done something wrong, or if so, how much they have to pay. The only instance in which this bill might have some effect on claims against those kinds of parties is if a class action was filed where it wasn't an individual homeowner saying this builder breached the warranty on their work, but it was instead an entire class of people, a group of hundreds perhaps of individuals who were all serviced by that builder, and they sought specific class action relief of the type described in this bill. This would change the procedures that apply to determining whether that can go forward as a class, but it doesn't relax any of the warranty requirements or other law that governs what those builders do and what they have to pay.
Thank you.
Senator Orton.
Mr. Chair, there may be others here that might like to testify against this, but I would like to move Senate File 149.
And are you moving it to the floor? Relaying it over? What?
I'm deferring to the other chair, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair, we can, if you'd prefer, we can just take additional testimony while we get a recommendation about where the bill
I guess, Senator Ortman, the bill, the proper motion would be that the bill be recommended to pass and be sent to the floor. We are going to allow for opposition testimony, but your motion at this point is that the bill be recommended to pass and that it move to the floor. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, for ease, I'll just withdraw the motion until we're certain where it's going to go.
That's fine. Yeah. Is there anyone else that wants to testify in opposition to the bill? Please approach the testifying table, please. Just have a seat, if you would.
Mr. Chairman, the earlier question. Yeah, before they start.
Okay, we've got, looks like, three testifiers up at the table. If you, the first testifier, if you would state your name, please, and proceed.
Prentice Cox. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome, Mr. Cox. Please proceed.
Thank you. I'm a professor of clinical law at the University of Minnesota Law School. I was formerly the manager of the Consumer Enforcement Division at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. I'd real briefly testify in opposition to this bill. A very, very brief history of the private attorney general statute is critical to understanding what's before you. The underlying statutes were passed in the 1960s, and in 1973, this legislature enacted the Section 8.31, Subdivision 3A, which is known as the private attorney general statute. For almost three decades, cases were brought under that statute until two critical Supreme Court decisions, Minnesota Supreme Court decisions, were issued in 2000 and 2001. The first decision is called Levy-Nystrom, and in that decision, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that all private rights of action under the statute were subject to what's called a public benefit restriction. And the essence of that restriction is that the plaintiff had to establish that the alleged misrepresentations were broadly disseminated. The second case was a year later in 2001, Group Health versus Philip Morris Tobacco Company. And in that decision, the court interpreted the language in Subdivision 3A of Section 8.31, saying that the plaintiff had to establish that the person was injured by the statute. The import of that decision was that the court specifically rejected what was in this bill unanimously and held that individualized proof of common law justifiable reliance, which is what this bill would do, was not the standard under the law, but rather that the plaintiff before it had simply to prove a causal nexus. The result of these two decisions over the last decade has reshaped the law as follows. All, virtually all, with very negligible exception, individual and family farmer plaintiffs no longer have a private right of action under the Minnesota consumer fraud statutes. None. The cases that were decided before 2000, such as a farmer in Cronebush who was deceived with the silo that was sold him, could not be brought anymore. Lease v. Lindmeyer, a homeowner involved in a sale who was deceived and awarded several thousand dollars by a jury as well as attorney's fees, could not be brought anymore. The result is that the only plaintiffs that can bring a consumer fraud statute under Section 8.31 since 2000 are either joinder plaintiffs or class action plaintiffs. So, first of all individual plaintiffs are already gone. So, thinking that somehow we're going to have individuals sue for their rights under these statutes, that no longer exists. So let's look at the class actions. Class actions have been limited in numerous ways under UDAP statutes. First of all, the federal courts have substantially used the public benefit test to limit class actions, although a very recent Minnesota Court of Appeals decision essentially clarifies that this whole line of federal court cases limiting class actions under public benefit is not appropriate. Class actions also are limited by this causal nexus test. In fact, the specific case that was brought that in which that test was enunciated, the group health decision, was ultimately held by the Eighth Circuit not to have sufficient proof to establish causal nexus, and therefore was dismissed as well. So the net result of our law is it's only class action cases and very large joinder cases that can be brought under UAP statutes. If you pass this law, Senate File 149, those cases are gone. You are essentially abolishing the private right of action. This is not hyperbole. You are essentially abolishing the private right of action under Minnesota consumer fraud laws. The Attorney General would continue to retain the ability to bring public actions, but individuals could no longer bring actions. That was the issue in group health. It has repeatedly been the issue in class actions. An example, Peterson v. BASF Corporation. Family farmers were, and throughout Minnesota, particularly up in the Red River Valley area, were sold two kinds of pesticides. And they were sold as premium and basic. And so they paid a premium for a certain kind of pesticide. In fact, they were the exact same thing. They just labeled them differently. It had the exact same product in it. A class action was brought of these family farmers. It was actually under the New Jersey Consumer Fraud Act, which is much more liberal than our limited act in Minnesota. But it involved Minnesota farmers and was interpreted by Minnesota courts. And the court held that a class action could be maintained there. If each individual farmer had to have alleged at the beginning of this case that every individual farmer heard about and relied on those representations, it is almost certain that that case would not have been certified. Those farmers would have had no remedy and never would have received relief for that fraud. It would have gone unpunished. The last statement I'll make is in response to the prior testimony. It is simply not the case that at the beginning of a class action, and I also will note that I teach civil procedure at the University of Minnesota, first year civil procedure, as well as advanced civil procedure courses. It is simply not the case that a class action can obtain affidavits or proofs of claim from individuals prior to the date that the class is certified. That's not economically feasible, and as far as I know, no class action in Minnesota, and I suspect not many anywhere, have ever involved proofs of claim prior to a certification of the class and an award to the class. So if you've ever been a recipient of a class action reward, you would have got something in the mail. But that's only after the class action is over. It's not the case that you can do that ahead of time. If that's what the legislative history is here, that would suggest to the courts that we have a new procedure as a result of this law. But under existing procedure, as it is right now, this statute eliminates class actions because individual actions are already eliminated. This functionally and practically eliminates the private right of action under Minnesota's statutory fraud consumer fraud laws. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Any further discussion? Would you identify yourself for the record?
Yes, I'm Sharon Van Dyke. I have a private practice in St. Louis Park, Minnesota. And I want to not repeat what the professor just said, but point out some basic practical considerations that I think are a big issue in this. Number one, and I think it's easily confused, is that this bill actually amends two different statutory provisions. The first one's the Private Attorney General's statute, and it's specific to what we call the consumer fraud collection of statutes, but it's really deceptive trade practices. It's targeted only at those businesses who are cheating, who are defrauding people. It's not targeted at businesses who are performing business in a good business practice way. If that's happening, nobody's using the statute to sue anybody. Its only use is for businesses or individuals who are defrauding people or using deceptive trade practices. I think that's really important to keep in mind. A small business ought to have a right to bring a claim against a bigger business or a competitor if their business is being hurt by deceptive trade practices. And under some of the language in this bill, that's impossible. This bill, as I'm reading it, prevents a small business or a business practice or a farm which is incorporated from bringing a claim at all under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act. I don't understand why we're discriminating against businesses when this is supposed to be a pro-business piece of legislation. It doesn't make sense to me. Number two, the actual reliance, I think the professor has discussed procedurally. I've been involved in class actions, and to my knowledge, you never put in proof of loss until after everything's over. I do want to address the second portion, which has to do with an automatic interlocutory appeal, which is a separate statute. It's a separate amendment. It's in this bill, and yes, it would affect class actions in the consumer context, but it's also going to affect any other class action in the state as I read this law, not just consumer fraud and deceptive trade practices. What you need to understand is that there's already a right of appeal within the judge's discretion if in the middle of the case, and those do happen. Number two, I don't believe the fiscal note that went along with this bill addresses the additional burden that this automatic right of appeal is going to place on the district courts, especially when coupled with the information in the first section. In order to have, procedurally right now, individual plaintiffs do not have to prove out-of-pocket loss, whatever that means, before the class is certified. That doesn't happen until the end. As I read these two together, what we've got is, in order to even get certified as a class, you have to prove individually detrimental reliance, and you have to prove out-of-pocket loss. Then there's a class hearing, and then that's immediately appealable. All the fiscal bill addresses is the cost to the Court of Appeals. It does not address, let's say you have 100,000 Minnesotans with the Cheerio boxes. What's the fiscal impact of a district court judge having to go through 100,000 applications to decide if there's been out-of-pocket loss before it goes up on appeal? I don't see that in the fiscal note. That's a very large burden on the district courts that they don't have, and it's a big vote against efficiency. And I will now turn my time over to my colleague on the right.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Would you identify yourself?
Senator, yes. My name is Jeff Haff, H-A-F-F. I believe I live in your district. I represent franchisees, dealers, and distributors nationwide with a law firm named Dady & Gardner, PA, in the IDS Center downtown. One of the problems I have with this bill, and there are numerous, is the whole idea that it applies only to natural persons. As has previously been stated, a lot of people do business as corporations. Under this bill, any corporation who's defrauded by consumer fraud actions, they're just simply out of luck. That would include all my dealers, distributors, franchisees who do business that way. That would include all family farmers who do business that way. That would include municipalities who are certainly not natural persons. I guess the lesson in this bill is defraud away on those folks because they have no claims whatsoever. Another issue I have with this bill is the issue of out-of-pocket loss. I don't think it's entirely clear from this bill exactly why these people have to prove out-of-pocket loss and whether their losses are limited by their out-of-pocket loss. Let's say, for example, in the situation that Senator Goodwin presented, the we'll take the ibuprofen situation or Vioxx. If this person bought Vioxx for a dollar and they ended up having to, ruin their life and have 4 years of surgery, is their out-of-pocket loss $1? Is this going to be the bill that says, congratulations, submit your claim for $1 under the Consumer Fraud Act? If the person is given Vioxx and doesn't pay anything for it, do they have no claim? If they are a child, they certainly don't have any out-of-pocket losses under any sort of consumer fraud because they didn't pay for it. So those people, they get to make a claim for nothing. Congratulations. That's what this bill is telling us today. The other issues I have with this bill are that we all seem to want to be clumping together these two bills. They are two separate bills. They don't deal with class actions that deal with consumer fraud. They deal with, one of them deals with consumer fraud, and the other deals with class actions. Okay, so what we, I would caution the committee here that we can't just clump them all together and say, well, what we're trying to cure here is class action fraud or something like that. They're two separate bills, okay? They impact two separate claims. On the class action portion, here's what the class action portion says. If I oppose a class action as a defendant and I lose, then I can immediately appeal to the Court of Appeals. When I lose there, I can go back down to the district court level, and then I can take a couple depositions and say, well, there's no typicality, there's no commonality, there's no nothing with respect to this class. I want to appeal again. And they can. They can appeal again. It just keeps going back and forth and back and forth. It's crazy. I don't understand the basis of why this happens. In addition, under federal law, the federal courts passed what they call the Class Action Fairness Act. It was a bill passed and signed into law by George W. Bush. The federal class action fairness law says the exact opposite of this law. It says you can't appeal these things as a matter of right. So I don't understand why a bill passed less than 10 years ago by the Bush administration is somehow an unfair treatment of class actions. I would think this committee would be prone to rule the exact opposite. The only other thing I would say is the initial premise of this legislation as read into the record today was that class action defendants have to face hundreds of discovery requests from different plaintiffs through different lawyers. If that's the premise of this bill, that's not even true. That's just not a true statement. We have class counsel for the class representatives. That's why we have class actions, okay? You don't have 10, 12, 14 different lawyers sending you different discovery requests, okay? That's what happens when you can't have a class action. That's what happens when you have 45 different people that are represented by 45 different lawyers. That's what happens then. So there are obviously a lot of problems with this bill, and I would ask that it either be amended or just defeated.
Any further discussion? Senator Ordman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quite a few comments there, and I'll address them as best I can. This bill is about...
Well, pardon me, Senator Ordman. I do want to make sure that we recognize a quorum in the room. Please proceed.
Thank you. This bill is about damages. We don't want to have plaintiffs in our courts that haven't actually incurred damages. And so that's why they're together, because we want to make sure that we have people that have actually incurred some injury before we're going through this whole process. One of the examples we heard was the farmer who was a member of a class regarding fertilizer. Well, this bill, all it says is that the farmer actually had to buy the fertilizer that was deceptive. That's all this bill says. The same is true with the Vioxx example. Somebody buys Vioxx, goes through 4 years of surgeries, ruins his life. He doesn't get to be represented. That's incorrect because the surgeries were a result of the bad medication. That's the kind of injury we're talking about. That plaintiff clearly can show some damages, clearly can show some injury, would absolutely be able to maintain a lawsuit for any damages. There are a couple other points I'd like to make, Mr. Chair. Line 2.6 of the bill begins with a statement, no award of damages in an action covered by the subdivision may be made without proof that the person or person seeking damages suffered an actual out-of-pocket loss. Pretty clear statement of the intent here. Can't be awarded. It doesn't mean you have to prove it in advance. And oftentimes, with the certification, it's the judge that's going to make the decision about what level of proof is required, whether there's an opt-in or an opt-out. The judge may, as Mr. Sylvester testified, may decide that somebody who can testify in an affidavit that they believe they bought Advil in a certain batch are qualified to be a member of the class. That's a decision that the judge often makes at the time of certification. So I think the comments, while well-intended here, don't really address what we're trying to address with this bill, which is it's a very reasonable thing to say plaintiffs in lawsuits should be able to establish that they were actually injured by the conduct of the defendant. Pretty straightforward. However, the testifiers here did make a very good point about natural persons. I think that's an error in drafting, certainly not intended, and so I would ask that line 2.1, Mr. Chair, be amended to strike the word natural.
Senator Ordman moves a oral author's amendment. Before we do that, Senator Ordman, Ms. Pontius wanted to make a comment.
No, Madam Chairman, I think that works. If you just take out natural there, then it still works.
Senator Ordman renews her motion to amend.
Mr. Chair.
Let me get through the motion, and then you can talk. Did you want to speak to the motion?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Senator Newman.
Senator Newman.
I apologize, Mr. Chair. The only question I had is, we strike the word natural, so now we have persons. Is persons someplace else in this statute defined as, you know, individuals, corporations, entities, et cetera?
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, it's not defined specifically in this statute, but that is the standard, that persons includes corporations and business entities and everything else. I can't imagine that the professor would disagree with that.
I can real quickly comment. There's a statutory presumption, Chapter 546, that does that.
Senator Ortman renews her oral amendment to subtract or to strike the word natural from lines 2.1.
To this amendment?
To the motion?
Mr. Chair, if the purpose is to allow corporations, then I think we might have to address the question on line 2.2 that has the purchase for the purpose as a personal, family, or household only. Is a family farmer who buys a silo doing that for personal, family, or household purposes, or for farm business purposes? We may need to look some of that language as well to address the point that's being dealt with in the proposed amendment.
Mr. Chair, I would consider that to be a friendly request on the part of Senator Latz, and we can add business on that line.
Senator Latz, could you specify what you might suggest as an amendment to the amendment?
Sure. On line 2.2, after the word family, comma, delete the word or. After household, insert comma, or business.
Any discussion on that oral amendment to the amendment? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Ortman, we return to your original oral amendment, striking the word natural from Lyons 2.1. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted, or amendment is adopted. Senator Ortman, any further discussion?
Any other comments?
Any further discussion by the members?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Ortman, to the what you had raised regarding the damages, the bill clearly says that a plaintiff is required to plead and prove before an award of damages can be made. So I agree with you on that. And I'm just wondering, I'm questioning the issue of the definition of out-of-pocket loss. And there's a lot of lawyer power sitting up there at that table. I'm trying to envision a situation where somebody would be an injured party in a class action suit who would not be able to meet the definition of the out-of-pocket loss, meaning money that they actually spent. It's just a question in my mind as to whether or not that situation might arise, and that person would be excluded from being able to participate because they haven't actually spent the money.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, the point of the bill is to make sure that we're talking about folks that actually purchased the good or service here and not someone like in the airline example wished they would have. I think that it's fair to say that you actually had to buy the product or the service or the box of Cheerios before you're damaged or ate the box of Cheerios at your neighbor's house and they bought the Cheerios. Somebody had to buy the Cheerios in order to maintain a lawsuit here.
Any further discussion? Sarah Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard the testimony that the federal government passed very different opposite language from this several years ago. Does that not supersede any Minnesota law we pass on the same issue? Does federal law supersede ours?
Senator Ortman.
May I address that?
Mr. Hatch.
Another problem with this bill is that the federal class action rules apply when in situations where not a majority or two-thirds or three-quarters or whatever of your plaintiffs are Minnesotans. Okay, if you have somebody who's done something really wrong to a bunch of Minnesotans, okay, they might have to stay in state court. Then they'd be subject to this law. Okay, so what we're saying by passing this law is if you were out-of-state folks, you'd have a lot better rights. You could go under the federal law. But if you're Minnesotans who have been hurt, you're out of luck. So that's why we have a federal law and a Minnesota law. The Minnesota law is only going to apply where a majority of the claimants, a majority of the injured people are Minnesotans. The Minnesotans will get the short end of the stick under this thing.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the federal law, Senator Goodwin, does not supersede here. We do get to set our own standards in Minnesota law and our own policies, and I think that's that is the intent here, is to say that Minnesota standards should say we're not going to have plaintiffs in courts of law when they haven't actually been damaged or acted in reliance on the defendant and their conduct. I think that's a good policy for us.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
But, Senator Ortman, why would we want people from another state to have access to a federal law that would help them a whole lot more than, why would we want it to be unfair to Minnesotans? Why would we even think that we should do that? I mean, Senator Ortman, is this language law in any other state? Is this just being introduced in Minnesota, or is there this law? Is this language any other state?
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that second question, Senator Goodwin. Perhaps Mr. Johnson does, and we'll see if we can't get an answer for you. But to the first point, if you really believe that we should all have the same standards as the federal government, then we don't need a state government. We don't need state policy. What we're trying to do here is set a standard for Minnesota lawsuits, and I think that's incumbent upon us as state legislators to do that. And we heard earlier about Minnesota case law, but it was case law and not statute. We're trying to set statutorily some standards for these very complicated lawsuits, and I think it makes sense for us to do that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Follow up, please. Here's another scenario. What if a company is a Minnesota company, or we can do this a number of ways, and there are people in other states that are part of this class action. Then I assume that they would go under the federal law, not this state law, correct? If it was a Minnesota company that was being sued, there was a class action suit against a Minnesota company, but there were people in other states that were also affected by this, and they were then part of the class action. Wouldn't they then be covered by the federal law rather than this state law?
Mr. Sylvester will have a better answer here.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin, my understanding is that the answer to your question depends upon whether the class of people that are suing that Minnesota company is predominantly composed of people from outside of Minnesota, or if in fact the majority of the people in the lawsuit are Minnesota residents. I'm not entirely certain that I agree with my colleague's characterization of the law that determines when federal rules apply to these cases. The intent of this bill, as I understand it, is to primarily govern actions that take place under Minnesota law, specifically those actions which assert a violation of Minnesota consumer protection statutes. And because of that, because it's primarily focused on people who can claim the benefit of specific Minnesota statutes, it's highly unlikely that you would have a class of people primarily composed of claimants from outside the state of Minnesota who would therefore jeopardize the application of Minnesota law as opposed to federal standards. The federal standards are primarily aimed at class actions that occur in federal court under federal rules.
Mr. Chair, one more question.
Senator Goodwin.
I also am concerned about that out-of-pocket expenses, how you'll define that is, because what if members of the class action have partial out-of-pocket expenses, but all their out-of-pocket expenses aren't calculated yet before they have to file or the class action. How does this bill cover that?
Senator Ortman or Mr. Sylvester?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Goodwin, if I may. The only requirement that the bill imposes in terms of proving out-of-pocket loss is that threshold requirement that they prove that they're a legitimate member of the class by proving that they spent money to buy the product or the services. This bill doesn't impose requirements in terms of the kind of proof that they need to show what they're entitled to recover. So this bill doesn't limit somebody's damages, and it doesn't prescribe what they have to present to the court ultimately to show I was hurt to the following degree. The only thing this bill does is it requires that to become a member of the class, they prove not the full extent of the damages that they might eventually calculate, but that they actually had some out-of-pocket loss, something that they spent to buy into that company's products or services, and therefore that they legitimately are part of the group of people who can claim to have been damaged by that company's conduct.
One final question, Mr.
Chair. Goodwin.
Could I ask the law professor to answer those questions for me as well?
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin.
The definition of out-of-pocket expenses, is that so limiting that that would cause problems? And what do you think would be the result of my example of a Minnesota company? But but people that are part of the class action that are also from other states.
Two separate issues, but
yes,
Mr. Chair? Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, the issue of out-of-pocket expenses, that there will be cases where there are clear fraud and there's a clear loss of opportunity, but you wouldn't have an out-of-pocket expense. Mr. Haff suggested a couple of those. A mortgage fraud where you actually get a mortgage so you don't spend any money, but the mortgage is 3% higher than was the market. You don't have an out-of-pocket loss probably. Our courts generally, you know, will find a damage for you there, but not if the statute says you have to prove out-of-pocket loss. Although the way Mr. Anderson's interpreting the language, once you show out-of-pocket loss, you can have other types of damages. That legislative history certainly would make it more amenable. I will say, though, real quickly, I don't think any of this matters, because if you pass this, class actions cannot be certified. Individual actions are out under the public benefit test. There is no private right of action. But if you think I'm wrong, you may also want to look at the phrase purchase of or lease goods, services, or real estate. That's the old language from 325F.68 that in 1996 in the Bobolik decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court was determined not to include mortgages. And so, in fact, it was even broader than that. So there's a good chance that if you do this, you're also eliminating all suits for mortgage fraud. I think you want to get rid of that phrase as well by substituting the current definition of merchandise under 325F.68, for instance, referencing that, or just simply reconstructing the sentence to get rid of that limitation. And then finally, to answer your question, the forum, whether it's federal or state, because of CAFA, the Class Action Fairness Act, depends on much more than just whether there's in-state or out-of-state plaintiffs. The class actions are fairly narrow now that can be brought in state court, but Senator Ortman is correct. There are different state court rules for when those actions can be maintained that aren't removable to federal court under CAFA. And those state rules would apply and not be preempted by the federal rules of civil procedure.
Mr. Chair.
Sarah Ortman.
Just to Professor Cox's point about mortgage fraud, it's pretty hard to imagine somebody being defrauded on a case of mortgage fraud without actually having incurred any cost whatsoever. That's pretty hard to imagine.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, I understand that there is a fiscal note, so I would ask that this bill be moved to the Finance Committee.
All right. Senator Ortman, some of our members have gone to a different committee that they are required to be a vote, and I promised them that they would have an opportunity to vote on these issues. So hopefully they'll be coming back shortly. Would you want to start explaining another bill? Or?
Mr. Chair, while they're out of the room, would it be possible to take a very short recess?
We could take a 7-minute recess, come back at 10 to 3.
Great, Mr. Chair, thank you.
As long as they're done voting upstairs, but if not, we may have to wait a few minutes, but we'll stand in recess until the call of the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.